Good morning, all. The case for argument this morning is Allen v. Buss. Mr. Kopp.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. The District Court erred in this matter when it denied relief on Mr. Allen's Atkins claim. At the minimum, the District Court should have ordered an evidentiary hearing occur, either back in state court or the District Court should have held that hearing itself. In Atkins, the Supreme Court narrowed the field of eligible offenders for the death penalty, categorically excluding the mentally retarded. Now, in Atkins, the Supreme Court didn't provide or endorse a precise definition of mental retardation, but it cited with approval the American Psychiatric Association's definition and the American Association of the Mentally Retarded definition of retardation, which mirrors the Indiana statute.
Because you mentioned Atkins, I'm going to take you a little bit off course, because there's something that I've really been wondering about. You say in your briefs that if we decide that Mr. Allen is entitled to an evidentiary hearing on the Atkins claim, it should take place in state court. Why is that? Mr. Allen presented that claim to the Indiana courts, and they declined to hold a hearing. At this juncture, wouldn't we ask the district court to conduct a hearing if we believed one was necessary? And isn't that precisely what is happening in the other circuits?
We argued basically for alternative relief on where the hearing should occur. Our position, based on Weishart and Mahaffey, where this court remanded for hearings in state court, in Weishart, there was a full-blown post-conviction hearing, and the claim wasn't fully developed, but it still remanded back to the state court. If I believe we cited a Fifth Circuit case, and there's a Sixth Circuit case that they sent back, because the eligibility determination should be made by the state court first. A federal court shouldn't be in a position of having to make that determination in the first instance. And granted, procedurally, we are different, but those cases out of the Fifth Circuit that we cited to that dealt with successors and remanding back to the district court for an evidentiary hearing, the state courts actually passed on the merits of the Atkins claim. We have never received a merits review of our Atkins claim. So our first argument is that the state court should make that eligibility determination first, and the federal court should review that eligibility determination.
Tom, would you say that your view that you haven't received an Atkins review in the state court is borne out by the majority position of the Indiana Supreme Court?
Not borne out. The majority position on the successor denial, we feel, is flawed. They say that the trial court on a sentencing remand decided that he wasn't mentally retarded, a sentencing remand that occurred 6 years prior to Atkins. We feel the dissent from the successor denial is more appropriate and more accurate, a more accurate depiction of the record.
When you applied for a hearing before Judge Tinder in the district court and requested a hearing, how contemporaneous was the evidence of the mental status of Mr. Allen? And I ask you that because of my concern of what he is today. I don't mean to avoid the central thrust of what happened at the time of sentencing, but what's our evidence of his condition today, or at least in 06?
We wouldn't have filed the Atkins claim initially in the habeas petition if we didn't have a good faith belief that we could sustain our burden. We had two IQ scores from when he was a child.
I understand those, but they had obviously a dated aspect to it, the 68-70 and the 104. What did you present to Judge Tinder as to what would be suggestion as his mental state at the time of requesting the habeas hearing?
Well, we relied on the evidence that was presented in the state court. I dispute, though, that 104 score. That's not an IQ score.
I only cite it because it's referenced. I'm not making any conclusion that that's appropriate. I'm just asking, at the time you sought habeas relief, of course, of which we are in direct review of, what had you done to convince the district judge for the need of the hearing? That you had a client who is currently, because you, certainly if he is currently mentally competent, there's a question of whether he could be executed.
Well, and if you look at the docket sheet of the district court, you'll recognize that when we initially filed his habeas petition, we raised an Eighth Amendment claim, and Atkins wasn't on the books yet.
I understand.
So when Atkins came out, we filed back in state court with the same evidence, requesting, invoking the Indiana Supreme Court's gateway function to allow us to get back to a fact finder to develop the factual evidence. When that was denied, we went back to the district court, again requested a hearing, and, you know, assuming the facts is true that were developed way back when in 1994, that was filed with the Indiana Supreme Court, and I received a paper hearing back in 1996, we felt that given those IQ scores, given a record supported four different areas of deficits in adaptive behavior, that at a minimum, assuming those facts is true, which we would be able to demonstrate that we may be entitled to relief. And given the fact that there was no evidentiary hearing in the state court on those issues, we felt that having the opportunity to have a hearing, we would be able to satisfy the Atkins retardation standard.
And then your view is, and I know that if Allen had been convicted after Atkins was decided, he'd be entitled to a hearing on whether he was mentally retarded.
Right. And in a sense, if you look at those successor cases, Allen's almost being penalized because he presented this evidence too early.
And then if the trial court had conclusively stated in 96 that he was not mentally retarded, I wonder, is it your view that he would be entitled to an Atkins hearing if that specific finding had been made?
I disagree that the trial court made the finding that he was not mentally retarded.
I understand
retarded.
That.
Is it implicit? Is that what the Indiana Supreme Court is saying? It's implicit because that the original sentencing judge considered it?
I mean,
I understand your position, and I respect that there's no a finding by the district court in the sense that we would see a specific language. But when the Indiana Supreme Court says that he did, and we have some requirement of deference there, are they saying that when it was raised at the sentencing and mitigation that he didn't completely consider it? What did he not consider the sentencing judge?
And that's sort of the confusion and the inconsistencies in the Indiana Supreme Court's decision. If you look at and we think that the language of the trial court opinion is where this court should go, where he actually says, I'm weighing this, I'm going to give it slight weight. The Indiana Supreme Court in direct appeal indicated that it was weighed. And again, appellant Allen in the direct appeal challenged the trial court's assessment of the mental retardation, and the Indiana Supreme Court made a specific finding, you can't complain about it because it was properly considered. In post-conviction, they denied the claim on the basis that, look, the trial court's already considered mental retardation, so we're not going to revisit that issue.
But I note from the briefing that Mr. Allen argued in post-conviction proceedings in state court that he may have been misdiagnosed as mentally retarded. Mm-hmm. How does that factor into our evaluation of the Atkins claim?
Two responses, Your Honor. One, if you look at how the Indiana Supreme Court considered that new evidence, and I think it's in footnote 34 of the post-conviction opinion, the Indiana Supreme Court specifically rejected that evidence. Second, it was dealing with an analytically distinct constitutional question of a Sixth Amendment violation, and that was before Atkins came out. If you look at some of the case law we cited, when you're talking about retardation considered as mitigation or what retardation or intellectual functioning in the context of a Sixth Amendment claim. You're talking about an analytically distinct claim. Now, the focus of that evidence changes, that fact changes, when it has different sort of legal repercussions to it. For example, and I use this as an analogy, consider the Roper v. Simmons case where they said anybody under the age of 18 should not be executed. Well, prior to that, when you're an attorney arguing in front of the jury, it doesn't make a difference if he's 17 years old in 360 days or 18 years old in one day, because you're still arguing your mitigating factor is youth. He's too young to be executed. Well, Roper comes out. That changes the significance of that fact. Now it is absolutely paramount for an attorney and for a court to know whether or not he's 17 years old in 360 days or 18 years old in one day. And the same holds true for retardation. When that claim was being litigated, that was well before Atkins, and the focus of the inquiry was different. Now that those facts take on an entirely dramatic and significant difference, the claim, you know, has this added importance.
So then your position would be that every person on death row who had mental retardation considered as a mitigating factor before Atkins would be entitled to an Atkins hearing.
I don't want to paint such a broad, assuming that they have, you know,
assuming there was,
assuming there's actually, you know, they have evidence of, you know, I don't, if somebody just argues my client's mentally retarded,
right,
and they don't have, like we have, scientifically acceptable testing measures and don't have at least four layers of, you know, adaptive functioning deficits, assuming that they have that, then they should. If it's only considered as mitigation.
Is it possible that the remedial education that Mr. Allen received when he was in grammar school may have helped him to take him out of the mentally retarded category? As I understand it, an IQ score of 68 or 70 suggests that Mr. Allen, as a child, was right on the margin between retarded and not retarded.
A couple of things. You're absolutely right, Your Honor, but those scores do place him well within the range of mentally retarded. And if you look at the progression of the scores, the 70 score that he received was when he was 7 years old, and then at the age of 10 he received a 68. And on both occasions he was maintained in special education classes for the mentally retarded. And if you look at, they also tested his ability to read. And when he was almost 13 years old,
right,
he was only able to read
first
month of
mm-hmm.
second grade. So,
The other thing that I was wondering is, even if the revised beta test has a tendency to overestimate a person's intelligence, how likely is it that the test given to Mr. Allen could have erred by a margin as wide as 30 or more points? Is there any evidence that when people whom the Stanford-Binet or Wechsler tests reveal that they're retarded, are they likely to score normal on the beta test? I know that the beta test has been widely discredited, and I wonder, is it even still being used? But
it's not being used to determine or to diagnose mm-hmm. mental retardation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the reason it's not being used is it doesn't meet the criteria. It's who does the testing, how it's done, and what it actually tests.
But what, in your view, would, you know, the 30 or more points point to? Anything?
The beta is meaningless. And the science report or sort of demonstrates One, because it's not testing the right areas, and it's how it's tested and who does the testing, that there's no way, and I think what you're getting at, Your Honor, is there a way to correlate that 104
right.
score and relate it back to the 70 or 68? Mm-hmm. And the science is just, it cannot be done because, it, as I think we cited it in our brief, one person described it, you're testing the five senses, and all you do is test vision, and you extrapolate from that how the other four senses are.
Mm-hmm. So go on to the Miranda claim.
Can I just, because I was
sure.
interested in this testing issue, too. So the bottom line is we can just, I mean, in terms of the value of the 104 beta test, it does not compare in any way to the regular IQ test.
Absolutely not. If Atkins relied on the APA and the AAMR, and that requires individualized standardized testing. The beta is a group test. It has to be administered by a trained professional. A beta in this case was done by a corrections officer doing intake for the Indiana prison. And it has to test the right areas. A beta is a speed and performance test. It doesn't test verbal reasoning, analytical reasoning, judgment, and memory. And the Stanford-Binet, the scores that we have, are valid tests, and he scored well within the range of Atkins retardation. And we can't save, as Justice Rodner was asking, we can't save the beta. We can't correlate it back and say, all right, 100's the equivalent of a 65. The science doesn't support that because the testing is so different as far as who does it, what it tests, and how it's done.
Before we move on, and I know Judge Rovner has a question in the Miranda area, I just want to stay just a moment longer in the area we're in now. You made a point, and I appreciate that point, on that there's a different focus, perhaps, by a trial judge in a pre-Atkins sentencing and a post-Atkins. I don't want to paraphrase this incorrectly. But
one would be sort of your Lockett-Eddings consideration, and the other would be...
Right. Right. But we have before us a crime committed in 87, I think.
Yes, I believe so, 86, 87.
Since 85, the Supreme Court has pretty, I think, clearly indicated in Fain and Wainwright that you can't execute. I'm not talking about sentencing now. Execute a mentally incompetent person. So what I want to say to you is, does a sentencing judge, even pre-Atkins, in considering... as this judge did, the factors dealing with the mental status of the defendant in a mitigation setting. And obviously he's not contemplating, or she, the sentencing judge, isn't contemplating that day that an execution is to occur
right.
immediately. But isn't he or she charged with knowing that the Supreme Court has just 2 years before indicated that if you have somebody who's severely mentally retarded or incompetent, they couldn't be executed. So how would that impact even a pre-Atkins analysis? I mean, knowing that you have that. I appreciate it's not quite the same thing as having Atkins before you.
And that's a very good question. You're talking about Ford versus Wainwright competency to be executed, where the Supreme Court categorically excluded those who are too incompetent to know why they're being executed. I think the difference is, and you have to sort of, you know, if you look at the timeline, like you said, we're stretching over 20 years here, or over 20 years here. And 1989 is when the Supreme Court came out with Penry, which said it's okay to execute the mentally retarded. So Indiana started that trend the other way, the consensus going the other way with the passage of its statute. I think... Given the Ford versus Wainwright test is so different from Atkins, we're sort of mixing apples and oranges because it's such an extreme level of lack of functioning to meet the Ford standard.
So do we have a petitioner before us, Mr. Kopp, who perhaps isn't at the Ford level?
At Ford, but meets Atkins.
But meets Atkins. So you think there's a gap in there that still could impact the analysis by a sentencing judge?
Absolutely. And I think when you're looking at that Ford, you have to look at what the Supreme Court said in Panetti, which is given the significance of this issue, you have to have adequate processes to allow the nuanced decision of that competency question in Ford to be be determined, and we've never had that opportunity. Our gate, you know, the Indiana Supreme Court didn't open up, didn't utilize our gatekeeping function to allow us to get back to a fact finder to fully air this. It's a nuanced question. Intellectual functioning goes hand in hand with deficits in adaptive functioning, and it's those two issues together that allow a court to make the nuanced decision of whether or not somebody's Atkins retarded.
Judge Rohner's inquiry about what might be the proper venue for a hearing, if there was to be a hearing before the district judge, obviously it would not be Judge Tinder in light of his new status. But if it was to return to the district court and a hearing were to be had, it would obviously encompass both areas, right? It would, because it would have a contemporary read, I would assume, of the mental status of Mr. Allen, which could address the Ford issue and could very well address, or in one fashion or another, the Atkins issue that you speak to.
Right. And the Ford, it's difficult with the Ford question. You know, as a lawyer and as this court knows, you know, competency can change over time. And so I'd be hesitant to say that when we get back to the district court, we'd actually be litigating a Ford claim. Right now, if ever, but we definitely have the evidence.
Well, but if the petitioner didn't meet the Ford standard, what would that speak to as to the Atkins standard?
It would have no relevance to the Atkins standard, and the Supreme Court notes that a mentally retarded individual can be competent and should be punished. But it excludes the death penalty. So, and it doesn't, being mentally retarded doesn't satisfy the insanity standard, and Atkins speaks to that. But what I was saying, probably not very articulate fashion, was that the Ford test is different. Although we've cited Panetti that talks about the importance of having factual development when you're talking about a category that if somebody meets, they're excluded from being executed.
In whatever venue it's heard in, the court would have to apply the Indiana mental retardation
standard
with conduct pre-22 and the other two factors that need to be reviewed.
Absolutely, and we're not disputing that. We just, for our belief, and I don't think Respondent Warden has contested this, is the Indiana statute echoes the APA's and the AAMR's definition.
All right, on to the Miranda claim. Could you please address the third interview that took place 10 hours after the polygraph exam and how that interview might have cured any problems with the polygraph interview? As I understand it, Mr. Allen made some of the same inculpatory admissions in the third interview that he did in the second. But he was given proper Miranda warnings at the third interview. And the third interview, of course, was conducted by a different police officer. He was allowed to speak to his mother and so forth. He had eaten.
Right. Our position on that is the warnings that he received were so atrocious regarding, you know, invoking your right to remain silent can be used against you, that the attorney that you get will be the class dummy, that an attorney can be pretty much anybody, including myself, and you're my client, that those warnings that he received from Detective Logsdon were so atrocious that it tainted any later warnings, because he would understand, or his view of what that warning would mean would be tainted by how Detective Logsdon's description of what those warnings meant. Our position is that the Indiana Supreme Court unreasonably applied Miranda because it relied on an earlier warning to cure the second warning, the inappropriate warning by Detective Logsdon. And our position is that third Miranda warning should be read in the context of what he received from Logsdon, which is invoking your right to remain silent can be used against you. Invoking your right to an attorney, it can be pretty much anybody, including myself, and you're my client, and I'm here to help you. He also indicated that, look, if you don't talk now, they're going to fry you. After they spend all this money, they're going to want the death penalty. That influenced the third statement.
Well, isn't if we would assume that Mr. Allen's statements during the polygraph should have been excluded, why wasn't any error in admitting the statements harmless? Wasn't there fairly compelling evidence of his guilt wholly independent of his statements? In other words, we've got the dentist's testimony. We've got the note with Mr. Allen's name on it. We've got the stolen camera. We've got the type A blood on his clothes.
And we don't hide from those facts in our brief. We even cite those facts. And even in the context of that, what you described, which appears to be very overwhelming evidence, the Indiana Supreme Court said that if Detective Logsdon's Miranda warning had been the only thing, then we would find error. But there's this earlier, so even the Indiana Supreme Court, in the face of that record, noted that they would likely find error if this was the only Miranda warning. So what we're saying is relying on that earlier warning is contrary to an unreasonable application of Miranda. And if you give credence to the Indiana Supreme Court's decision, if that was erroneous, then that bar that they imposed from granting relief on this Miranda violation is lifted, and it's likely to have affected the trial.
And I want to clarify some of the statements that he made. That statement that where he confessed that he hit Ms. Griffin, did he do that after the first Miranda?
Yes, that's my recollection.
I just wanted to be sure. So, in addition to the factors that Judge Rovner lays out in terms of the evidence, we do have that statement after the first proper Miranda.
Yeah, yes. But it came on the heels, I believe, of Logsdon's.
No. That's why I wanted to clarify. I thought he was given Miranda the first time. Then he confessed that he hit her. No? Is this it?
I'll double check the facts, but I think it was, and Mr. Creason may correct me on this, I think it was he was given Miranda, didn't say much. Logsdon gave him
So there was no reference to hitting her after the first Miranda.
Right. And there's evidence that was developed in post-conviction regarding Logsdon sort of planning that whole theory that she caused it. And that then appellant adopted that.
Then I had another question. Is there any evidence at all that the officers knew or suspected he was mentally retarded?
I think they knew that he was slow. I don't know if they used the label mentally retarded. So I don't want to say that they knew that he was mentally retarded. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kopp. Mr. Creason?
May it please the court. Mr. Allen has litigated his mental retardation, that factual question, three times before the Indiana courts. The first time was 2 years after Indiana had outlawed the execution of the mentally retarded. While admittedly that statute did not apply in Mr. Allen's case, the factual definition of mental retardation and the scheme that it set up did apply. The legal remedy did not. And as Mr. Comp has mentioned, Indiana's definition, which is crucial to Atkins and the finding of a national consensus, has not changed and has been consistent throughout.
Well, an Atkins hearing would focus on the sorts of clinical factors that the Atkins opinion discussed and that are also referenced in Section 3536.9.3c of the Indiana Code and the Indiana Supreme Court's decision in Pruitt. Namely, whether the defendant has a significantly sub-average level of intellectual functioning, whether the defendant's adaptive behavior is substantially impaired, and whether these existed before the defendant became 22 years old. Where, for instance, in Judge Barney's mitigation analysis, are there findings as to these criteria?
As an initial matter, Your Honor, I don't believe that any state court is required to give detailed findings about each and every little point on mental retardation. It's the overall findings.
These are not little points.
These are the whole
kahuna, the whole ballgame.
Judge Barney specifically talked about the adaptive functioning, and he talked about the various IQ levels. Those are precisely the standards in which the questions as to mental retardation. Did he have substantially limited functioning? Was he able, in other words, is his adaptive functioning significantly impaired? Judge Barney did discuss that in his order. He also discussed the intellectual functioning prongs, which are the various IQ tests. Interestingly, Dr. Deaver's, which was the only evidence on mental retardation, the other affidavit is by a school administrator merely explaining what the records say, but offers no opinion. Dr. Deaver did not even meet or analyze or test or examine Allen in any way. The only thing he did was he looked at what are now 50-year-old IQ scores and did not have any of the data or the actual testing reports on that. He had merely the conclusion of the tester that this is what the IQ score is. And having been involved in several mental retardation hearings, what the doctors, and this is admittedly my testimony here, but for to the extent that it helps the court, what would happen in a hearing is the experts would need to know more about those scores, just as we would need we know more about the beta score. We would need to know more about what the testing environment was, or what exactly the questions were, how the person scored it. Because many experts rescore the tests and come up with different results.
Forgive me.
I'm sorry.
Doesn't all that, aren't you really making, Mr. Allen's
case
argument for him? You're making his case for him. We haven't had any of that. Can we equate a hearing that treats mental retardation merely as a mitigating factor with a hearing that recognizes retardation as an absolute bar, just an absolute bar to execution? I mean, I just really have had a terrible time understanding how a trial court's mitigation analysis suffices as an Atkins Eighth Amendment hearing. And, I mean, when Judge Barney considered Mr. Allen's evidence of mental retardation, he did so years before the Supreme Court decided Atkins, and he did it outside of an Eighth Amendment context.
With all due respect, actually, it was inside an Eighth Amendment context because the weighing of mitigating circumstances within Eighth Amendment, although I'll admit a different focus. But the ultimate factual question, as Chief Justice Shepard pointed out, is Allen mentally retarded? And as the cases in the various circuits, including the supplemental authority that Allen submitted to the court a couple weeks ago, pointed out, that that factual question doesn't change over time. And Indiana had set out a criteria for mental retardation, and that was applicable in Judge Barney's review of that. It was implicit in it, because the Indiana Supreme Court discussed it and told him to review it under those terms, and the Indiana Supreme Court later reviewed it under those terms. Also, Your Honor, Allen has actually had the opportunity to have second doctors come in and examine his scores and figure out whether or not he's mentally retarded. He presented those experts in the post-conviction hearing who uniformly said he is not mentally retarded, that Dr. Deaver's perfunctory review was flawed. It was incomplete, and he didn't know what he was doing. And had he known other things, he would have learned that actually what is masking as mental retardation to Dr. Deaver based upon looking at some school records and no actual evaluation of Allen. After you evaluate Allen, he's not actually mentally retarded, but the reason that he was in special education classes and other things is because he has a severe learning disability and some other characteristics that make it difficult for him to learn.
But the trial court, of course, didn't say those things as clearly as you're articulating them. And when the court described Allen's evidence of mental retardation as tending to show a mitigating factor, but is a very slight mitigating factor, doesn't that sound like a conclusive determination that he's not mentally retarded? I mean, doesn't that indicate that the trial court thought he was somewhat mentally retarded? I wanted to get back to the trial court statement.
Well, of course, the trial court statement is only one part of the evidence that we have.
I understand that, but I'm just saying this tending to show it's a mitigating factor, but a very slight mitigating factor. Isn't that an indication the trial court thought he was somewhat mentally retarded, but was weighing these other things and found it outweighed it?
Respectfully, no, because if you read the rest of it, he points to other evidence that says that erodes that as a possibility. So while at one point in time, Judge Barney's order shows that he's carefully considering the question of the mental retardation as he was ordered to do, and in the end concludes that there is no real evidence of any weight to suggest that.
There any expert who opined that he was not mentally retarded?
No, all you had was Dr. Deaver's affidavit, and Mr. Allen had the opportunity to ask for a hearing to present more evidence, but never did. So to the extent that he's claiming he did not actually receive an evidentiary hearing before the trial court, that is entirely Allen's fault. And the trial court mentions that that he had the opportunity, but did not present evidence, so we can't even cross-examine the witnesses.
Mr. Creason, you're speaking now of the mitigation hearing?
Yes.
At the original sentencing stage?
That's correct. And then, in post-conviction, just a couple of years later, Allen himself brings in the experts that counter any evidence of mental retardation, actually did an evaluation of Allen, examined him for mental retardation and other alternative possibilities, and determined that actually his problems was primarily a learning disorder that is exacerbated by the fact that the Indianapolis public schools in the 1950s just did not give adequate attention to special education, and he never had a chance to learn or to develop the skills needed to succeed academically, and to a certain extent also socially and other things. The licensed clinical social worker, top licensor for social workers, and qualifies her as an expert, testified about the details of his upbringing and actually concluded agreeing with the psychologist that said that he was not mentally retarded, said that that's true, and that these things are best explained by environmental factors, not inherent factors such as mental retardation. Then, whenever Atkins is decided, Mr. Allen comes to the Indiana Supreme Court and says, see, Dr. Deaver's affidavit says, an affidavit based upon no actual examination of the defendant and 50-year-old records, says, this is my evidence of mental retardation. Mr. Allen's attorneys are well versed in how to bring evidence before the Indiana Supreme Court on a successive PC application. You can present affidavits and other documentary evidence to suggest that there's new evidence or something more that the court needs to know. The evidence is silent about the beta. Any discrediting of the beta test and what it means and actually what happened, whether or not it was a correctional officer or probably more accurately, an actual psychologist or other trained individual doing the test, that's all outside the record. He could have presented this stuff, including a current affidavit that suggested that his PCR evaluations done by his own experts were flawed, but he didn't.
Well, are you arguing that the state courts were correct to place so much reliance on the revised beta test that indicated that Mr. Allen had a normal IQ? I mean, a test that's been so roundly rejected as a reliable indicator of an individual's intellectual ability.
No, I'm not saying that it carries.
That test is some sort of a joke.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think that the experts in this area would not say that it is a joke, dramatically overstates it.
No, I don't think so.
I've heard an expert testimony on the fact, and the beta has some roles. I'm not suggesting, though, that they are nearly as strong as a Sanford-Binet or a Wechsler test. That is true. They are not. Those are by far more accurate examinations of one's IQ.
You're talking about the gold standard.
Yes, Your Honor.
Vis-a-vis something that every true expert in the field has roundly rejected.
And Your
this
Honor,
is an area that I have really, really looked at carefully.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And all that Mr. Allen or his attorneys would have had to have done was actually present an affidavit that said that. But Dr. Deaver did not. The record is silent about the beta. And so, based on the evidence that the Indiana courts had before them, which is the only evidence, respectfully, this court can review in determining the reasonableness of the Indiana court's determinations, based upon the evidence the state court had, that was a valid test. Now, I'm not suggesting that it carries nearly as much weight. I am not at all. I am in full agreement with Your Honor. However, as Judge Flom mentioned, it may have some relevance in the overall examination, especially since we know nothing at all about the first two tests given to him 50 years ago.
Well, we know that they were Sanford-Binet and Wechsler.
We do, and we also know that they've been replaced several times with tests because those initial tests had flaws themselves, and today's tests would be much more accurate. And Mr. Allen, today, taking a test, any expert would say that would have to be given minimal weight because of the legal situation that he is in and the fact that those just cannot be reliable scores. Now, there's no doubt.
Oh, forget.
Oh,
go
I'm
ahead,
sorry.
Finish your phone.
Oh.
Then you might need the paper you dropped.
Oh, I'm. Thank you, Your Honor. I should also mention that the post-conviction evidence, he actually did not just raise an ineffective assistance claim. He also raised, and if you read his brief in the Indiana Supreme Court, a freestanding claim that he is not mentally retarded, and the trial judge erroneously considered evidence that he's mentally retarded. And in light of that, the Eighth Amendment requires him to be resentenced or his sentence to be revised based on inaccurate sentencing information, which is really a corollary to any other Eighth Amendment claim, that there's something here that you didn't know, for instance, mental retardation, or that you weren't mentally retarded, and you have to consider. The totality of the facts here, and based upon what the state courts had, there is ample evidence for the Indiana Supreme Court to exercise the gatekeeping function that Atkins authorizes and, in fact, directs state courts to use. Here, he has to show a reasonable possibility of success. The only evidence of success on the merits of the claim is the affidavit by Dr. Deaver, who did not, of course, examine him. But then, that is entirely discounted, rendered meaningless by his evidence just a couple of years later and arguments in court that Dr. Deaver's affidavit is bunk. And faced with that, any state court is eminently reasonable in concluding that the evidence as a whole shows no reasonable possibility of success on the merits.
Now, that was at the first post-conviction, Mr. Greeson, that they offered the affidavits challenging the Dr. Deaver's...
That's right, which was used both for an Eighth Amendment claim, a state resentencing claim, using the state Supreme Court's powers to review residents in IC.
The content of those affidavits, could you just summarize what they represent?
The affidavits...
They were presented to challenge the Deaver's finding.
They were actual live testimony, Your Honor. And I have record sites for those.
What type of hearing was that?
I'm sorry, what hearing?
What type of hearing was that then?
That was an evidentiary hearing on Mr. Allen's post-conviction claims
didn't focus on exclusively on his mental status. It was challenging the conclusion earlier presented by his attorneys in mitigation?
It was doing that. It was challenging his current mental state and current functioning and functioning at the time of the crime and any aspect that that affected in his trial, whether that be the performance of his counsel at both the appellate stage, the motion to correct errors stage, or at, also at trial with mitigation. And, of course, there were also many other claims. But
I'd like to ask you, please, if we were to conclude that Mr. Allen is entitled to an Atkins hearing, where, in your view, should that hearing take place? In the Indiana courts or in the district court?
Well, there certainly is some authority.
Too horrible to contemplate?
No, certainly not, Your Honor. You know, that's difficult. Ultimately, I think it's probably on this court's discretion. There is some authority in this circuit that says that it could go back to state courts. However, we think that if the court were to do that, it would, of course, have to issue a writ of habeas corpus before it could remand something to state court. And there is no objectively unreasonable determination in light of the fact that he has no clear and convincing evidence that he's retarded. He himself refuted all of that evidence. In light of that, I think the most the court probably should do is remand it back to Judge Tender's court, whomever, whatever judge sits on that, whether it's Judge Tender or another district judge. Also, I don't think the state has an opinion or really that matters a great deal, too. But ultimately, I suppose it depends on you. I would say, however, that if the court were to remand it to state court, it would have to be an alternative writ of some sort, and that the alternative writ should read, either the state court grant the hearing or the federal court will have to do the hearing, and an alternative rather than remand it for resentencing. In other words, in Weishart, it was the state courts need to redo some of the post-conviction evidence or grant him a new trial. But that was in the context of Weishart's claim, which is was a jury tampering type claim. So that's different.
Could we talk about Miranda? Because you're...
Certainly.
Okay. Before we go to Miranda, could I just finish up on...
Ms. Greeson, following up on Judge Rovner's inquiry about possible venue in the event there was a hearing ordered, wherever that hearing was held, and let's just for argument's sake say it might be the district court, does a Ford Wainwright analysis occur at the same time?
It could if the court wanted one. I don't think that
the district court
or the district court, either one. However, I don't think that Mr. Allen is claiming, it doesn't sound to me as if he's claiming there is that issue. However, evidence about that is going to necessarily take place in any mental status evaluation and any mental retardation.
Yeah,
it's going to be implicit.
Well, I understand your position that it may be hard to evaluate responses in because of the legal setting, but that is what it is. Because of the, let me call it a mixed approach taken as to mental status and then post-conviction approach, I, for one, have just some concern about the contemporary situation, even though it's not a direct point raised. But, of course, I think it lays before us as it lays before the state. It would be, some final pleading would be made at some level in the state on that issue. So I guess it wouldn't matter who conducted that analysis, whether state or federal, but I'm just concerned about the contemporary situation because of this zigzag approach that has been evidenced in courts below.
Yes. Any hearing at this point, and any examinations at this point in whatnot, are going to be highly suspect. It's going to be extremely difficult to come up with any conclusions.
Of course, if it was done in the context of his confidence at the present time, that's a wholly different question than what the primary focus would be in this hearing, which would be, did he meet the Indiana standard?
Yes, although if there are underlying mental illnesses involved, that would suggesting competency, that actually dramatically affects the IQ testing and the adaptive functioning testing. It may actually render it impossible to do, because if you suffer from a severe mental illness, although none is alleged here, that completely affects the mental retardation examination, just to the point where it's just no longer reliable. Or so the experts have told me in the past. Judge Roedner, if I can also mention one other part about the remand, if there is a remand, I would like to correct a point that opposing counsel made, which is that it would be focused only upon Indiana's standard for mental retardation. And a hearing in federal court would also need to evaluate what the Supreme Court pointed out, which is whether or not Allen is among the class of offenders of which there is a total national consensus. And the state would like to point out that national consensus, Justice Ginsburg in her majority opinion pointed out, actually includes that it's 60 or below. That in a number of states, the cutoff for mental retardation at the time Atkins was decided was 60. In a number of states, an IQ of 60. And you had to be below that before you would qualify. And the point in Atkins was he had a score of 59, although that was debated, and that put him enough within that he would qualify for the hearing. So the question for the district court would not only be whether or not he's mentally retarded under a clinical definition, but the clinical definition is not the national consensus at the time of Atkins.
But when you responded to Judge Williams, your response was that the district court would have to use the Indiana statute as its...
Well, yes, there are two legal questions. One is the factual one, the same one that has existed throughout this case. Is he mentally retarded? And that's a clinical definition. But then in order to get relief as a legal matter, you have to be so mentally retarded as to qualify within the national consensus. So that's the legal question, not the factual one. If that makes...
It's something I'm going to have to go back and think about.
Yeah, it would definitely be a question which we would be raising.
Right, because you're saying that this national consensus position would trump the Indiana statute, basically, if the national consensus is at 60.
Yes. That's right, or whatever level the national consensus is. And that's because the Eighth Amendment is on national standards of decency, and if the national standards are not the clinical definitions, because people who are mentally retarded can actually function.
Obviously, I have to go back and look as well as Judge Roedner. You're saying that's clearly stated by Justice Ginsburg.
Justice Ginsburg, I don't have the opinion before me. It's on the table. Says that that just because you would be mentally retarded under the clinical definitions does not mean that you would be so mentally retarded as to be exempt from execution as a national consensus matter. That is in her opinion, I believe, at the end of Section 3, I believe, but it might be the end of Section 4. I'm thinking it's Section 4. Judge Roedner, you wanted to discuss...
I thought we would talk about Miranda in the 5 minutes that you have left. And basically, I wanted to ask you the very same question. Because I'm just wondering how confident we can be that third interview was untainted by whatever took place during the polygraph examination. Because, you noted in your brief that Mr. Allen made some of the very same incriminating statements in the third interview. Mm-hmm. After he was properly Mirandized, that he had made in the polygraph examination. And one thing that I also wondered was whether the record will tell us to what extent his statements during the polygraph examination may have been brought up during the third interview.
I'm not sure if there's multiple questions there. Let me address the last one, sure. the one I actually remember, which the record, I don't think, specifies to the extent that they were saying, well, you told Detective Logsdon this. Is this what happened? Detective Logsdon's was not the formal statement, and what police were going after, wanted him to give, was a formal tape statement, cleanup statement. This is what you're going to say. And that exactly mirrored what he told Detective Logsdon. But Detective Logsdon's, I'm not going to defend Detective Logsdon's explanation, or that's been declared deplorable by the Indiana Supreme Court, something which the state agrees with. We have never actually defended those comments, but we've defended his statements as a whole. They completely parrot. There was actually very little. It was not a confession. And he asked for the polygraph. They brought Detective Logsdon in. They had their discussion. This took place over a number of hours. And as the polygraph went on, Allen was caught up in his own lie. And the polygraph showed that he was lying. And whenever Detective Logsdon stated, the polygraph says, you're being untruthful to me, Allen immediately changed his story. And that is the story that then he stuck with, which is that he was at the house. He actually never denied he was at the house once he was under arrest. So he placed his presence there, and that he had talked to Mrs. Griffin. The story before he was shown his
untruthfulness. Let's start with what he said after the first Miranda, and then so we can get the sequence, because that's what I was trying to get at before. So tell me exactly what he says. It says he didn't say much. What does that mean? Yeah, after the first Miranda, tell me exactly.
In his non-custodial, that's really the first. The non-custodial questioning, when he was just what we thought was a witness, he pretty much disavowed things. But then they discovered the evidence of the camera and some other things, puts him there. And he said, okay, I was there, but when I was there, she was cussing at me, and she chased me off with a butcher knife. And then that's the story he told Detective Logsdon at the beginning of the polygraph. He said, I can take a polygraph, and, okay. So then we get to the polygraph. Detective Logsdon does his thing. After that, he does the questioning. In the course of the questioning, we get the untruthful response in the polygraph. He's confronted with that, and he says then, okay, I was there. She was cussing at me. I hit her in the face. I think he said with his fist at that point in time. And I did not kill her. I did not stab her. And, and that's the end of that. And then I'll give a tape statement to that effect. Then he refused the tape statement. They let him go back. 10 hours pass. They ask him again. He waives his rights orally but refuses to sign anything. And he gives the exact same statement, that he was there, that she cussed, except instead of hitting him with the fist, he says she slapped her. But in the entire time, he denies it. Those are really the only statements that would ever be it. So I think the Indiana Supreme Court's adjudication on this is not objectively unreasonable. Allen points to no cases that would suggest it's even incorrect, let alone objectively unreasonable. And, of course, all of this is harmless under the Brecht v. Abramson standard, if not under the Chapman v. California standard, as the Indiana Supreme Court determined. I would like to conclude by going back to the Adkins point briefly and summarizing, if I may, which is that Adkins v. Virginia changed the legal landscape in the sense of the remedy that Allen would be entitled to if he were mentally retarded. But the factual question of that has always been there. And Allen has sought relief under various ways of adjudicating his mental retardation, even so far as to change his story and present evidence that says he is not. In light of that, Allen has no clear and convincing evidence that establishes his right to an evidentiary hearing in state or in federal court. We ask that you affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Grayson. Mr. Kopp?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Appellant has never had the opportunity to litigate the Atkins eligibility factor. The paper hearings that the state courts rely on occurred in 1996, referenced evidence back in 1988. And I want to dispute the respondent warden's characterization of what could have happened on that sentencing remand. There was a stipulation from the trial court judge where, quote, Judge Barney did not conduct a sentencing hearing because the order did not require it. So it didn't require the presentation of live testimony. There was no misunderstanding by appellant or the trial court or the state, for that matter, what was going to occur. It was sent back to prepare a sentencing order. The Indiana Supreme Court had him on tight deadlines to get it back up to him in 30 days and even assumed that the sentence was going to be reimposed because it required the appellant to file the supplemental record. So everybody knew what the story was when that case went back. It's going back to correct this error and consider this new evidence and give it weight.
Mr. Bob, considering the clear and convincing standard, what is your response to Mr. Creason's pointing out the, and I think Judge Rovner in an early question also noted it, the position taken at the post-conviction hearing where it in effect challenged the evidence presented in mitigation?
Well, I think twofold. I think, and we cited in our brief the Rastafari case where the Indiana Supreme Court dealt with the identical issue and still remanded for an evidentiary hearing on an Atkins claim where he ultimately was given relief. The nature of the claim was different, and it's analytically distinct. And earlier I said footnote 34. It's footnote 25 from the post-conviction petition where the Indiana Supreme Court rejected that evidence. Again, if you look at the district court didn't rely on the fact that there was sort of a collateral position taken in a state collateral proceeding, and nor did the Indiana Supreme Court in ultimately denying the Atkins claim. It did reference that it happened, but I think it's the second to the last paragraph in the successor where it says, oh, by the way, they also argued this. But that wasn't the basis of the state court's denial on the Atkins claim in the successor. It was the claim had been raised before. Well, it hadn't because it couldn't. And when it was raised in under the Indiana statute, the Indiana Supreme Court said we're not going to consider it. This post-conviction opinion, they again affirmed that the trial court considered the mental retardation evidence, given its light weight. And the successor post-conviction opinion contains internal inconsistencies. It initially recognizes that it was weighed and then later says it wasn't. So I think, we have demonstrated that the state court treatment of this is unreasonable given the record in this case. It's inconsistent, and I see that I'm out of time.
Well, can you just, though, address this the Atkins national consensus issue, whether you think that what Justice Ginsburg said, and the national consensus would trump the Indiana statute in terms of the 60 being the national consensus for mental retardation?
For fear of sounding like an attorney general from Indiana, I believe that Atkins itself said that we're going to leave it to the states and that the test to be applied would be the Indiana statute. The consensus language was used in a construct of whether or not this category has developed to exclude the mentally retarded from execution. So wherever the hearing is, and we feel it should be in state court should make that eligibility finding, it should be the test to be applied is the Indiana statute. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Kopp. Mr. Creason and Ms. Kopp, I want to thank you both additionally for your able advocacy in this capital case on behalf of the state and the petitioner. All right, the case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.